It's the Burt Cohen Show. Sometimes the dream turns out to be, frankly, a nightmare for some of the many thousands, if not millions, of people affected by America's foreign policy. Boy, we are witnessing some messy situation in Iraq right now. And I got to tell you, I look back to 2003. As my dad lay dying back then, he was deeply upset at the pending invasion of Iraq. He had a pretty decent understanding of 20th century American foreign policy, and it was obvious to him what an unmitigated disaster it would unquestionably become. Now here we are, perhaps at the end of one disaster in Iraq, maybe at the beginning of another. I don't know. It's pretty scary. Our guest today, I'm very pleased to have with us Patrick Smith. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Oh, a pleasure, Burt. You're welcome.
He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. He was the International Herald Tribune's bureau chief in Hong Kong and then Tokyo from 1985 to 1992. During this time, he also wrote Letter from Tokyo for The New Yorker. He is the author of four previous books and has contributed frequently to The New York Times, The Nation, The Washington Quarterly, and other publications. Patrick, again, thank you for being with us. In your new piece on Salon.com, you write, "Foreign policy, at least the American kind, is like a stone thrown into a pond. The ripples outward go on and on," end quote. This horrific violence we're witnessing in Iraq right now, the tragedy now unfolding, what was the stone thrown into the pond? Was it how much of it is a reaction to Bush, George H.W. Bush, invasion of Kuwait, or Bush II's invasion of Iraq, combination of both? What was the stone thrown into the pond, do you think?
You can go back. It depends on what level of history you want to start examining, Bert. I drew a line at 2003 with the invasion for the sake of a column that was going to do. There's a straight line from the invasion of March 2003 to what we have now. The project was to disassemble a nation and put it back together again in another way. But prior to that, you can go back to Bush 1 and the invasion of 1990 or 91, whatever it was. Or, if you like, some of my readers do this. No, you have to go back to the Brits and the Anglo-French carving up in the lines on the maps, early decades of the 20th century, right, et cetera.
Right.
One reader said, wait a minute, you got to go back to the Crusades. There's something in that. I mean,
yeah.
Notable that Bush defined his enterprise as a religious undertaking, right? It's in their record. He was very clear about that. Why? Well, there are perverse echoes to things that happened a very long time ago. I don't find that entirely far-fetched.
Not at all, certainly. I mean, it wasn't there before. Now, could these ripples, as we're now seeing, how easily could they have been predicted? And as I mentioned, my dad had this sense as he lay dying that, wow, this is going to be really bad. How predictable was what we're witnessing now?
Well, I wish I were sitting in front of the fire in the kitchen watching television with your dad in March of 2003, because I thought the exact same thing, and so did the very dear people I was watching TV with at the time. It was an entirely predictable calamity. One could not understand. Here's where I came from on it. Okay, I spent many years in the East. All right, many of those years in Japan. I developed a reasonably intimate familiarity with the occupation. All right, the planning for the occupation began in the early 40s. By the time MacArthur got there and got the document signed on the deck of the Missouri in 45, there was a very, very complex structure ready to get mobilized. All right, that was an occupation, whether you like it or not, beside the point. With some thinking, right? With some understanding of the people, society, culture, etc., to be occupied. Nothing in this case. I took exception to that comparison. I think that the comparison was intended to serve what's called the victory culture. You know, we're going to do this. The occupation goes down in American history books as having it has a very good reputation in American history books. There are things to say about that. Another conversation. But that was the sort of social memory to be drawn upon. Absolutely misleading. There was no planning whatsoever. A few days after the invasion, I don't remember how many, we had that ridiculous scene of Bush plopping down on the aircraft carrier,
right,
mission
right.
accomplished. That was about as deep as those guys intended to go.
It's funny, but it's terribly sad for all the incredible disruption.
It takes the breath away when you think these people are running the country and rather regrettably have a great deal of say in running the world.
Well, let me ask this. What was the Iraq that George W. Bush set out to destroy? I mean, here was a tyrant, a hated tyrant, but how bad was it? How different, how unique a tyrant was Saddam Hussein? What was the Iraq Bush set out to destroy?
I don't, Bert, you choose your own vocabulary, of course. I don't use words like tyrant and terrorist and so forth. I think they're distractions, okay? They draw people in two dimensions. If you call someone a terrorist, you don't have to understand anything about that person or what that person is doing, what he or she is doing.
Terrorist, absolutely.
That's it. That's all you need to know.
Yep.
Same with tyrant and so forth. I don't think Saddam Hussein was somebody you would want to have over for dinner, all right? Does that single him out? No, it does not. Indeed, he kept pretty good company with Americans when he was useful. All right?
Right.
That's a matter of record. So these pictures we form of people such as Saddam are in the service of policy, okay? Remember, Stalin was Uncle Joe when Uncle Joe was handy to have.
Right.
He wasn't Uncle Joe when Truman got into office,
that's
isn't
for
that
sure.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to watch that. I'd like to characterize Saddam as somebody, and as the inheritor, or one of the inheritors, of a nation drawn on maps by the English in rather arbitrary fashion.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do? It could be pretty rough game, right? As we are seeing right now. You want to reflect upon Saddam, look at what's going on now, and then reconsider what you might think of Saddam. A nice picture? No. I'm not sure any worse than what we have now. I mean, the alternative, the Nigerians have thought of it, and many others, or some others. Maybe we don't need these lines on maps. That's come up.
Mm.
All right? So I have what I call in the column you mentioned, my Tito thesis.
Yes.
All right?
I was going to ask about that.
Tito, to the ordinary American, was, you know, another East European despot, all right?
Mm-hmm.
However, in the upper reaches, as I say in the piece, it was understood to be more complex than that. Tito was, his great sin was non-alignment.
Right.
We didn't dig non-alignment.
True.
Right? That's another thing we sort of dissed, to use the vocabulary. We discredited as thoroughly as we could. I never bought into that. Non-alignment was actually a really rather honorable way to see nations into the independence era.
Yes.
Okay? These names, Nehru, Nereri, and so on, these are all flawed. Who isn't in a top position? But honorable men with something we don't have any of now.
Mm.
Right? They
yes.
did what they wanted. So Tito had a concatenation of ethnicities and communal animosities and so on and so forth, and he held the nation together. How did he do it? He did it by making sure all these constituencies had their place at the table in a way satisfactory and conducive to peace and quiet.
Yes.
All right? That's the Tito thesis.
And Tito, you know, Yugoslavia, of course, is no more, but the various nations that made up Yugoslavia, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, Herzegovina, this is where the First World War, you know, it was the flashpoint for the First World War. He held it together, which is really amazing.
And incidentally, another matter, the thesis, I think, is very useful in measuring situations such as Iraq, okay?
Yes.
However, I don't want to put Marshal Tito in the file with Saddam particularly. I don't think it serves Tito very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tito, if you look at his record, was quite well regarded by his own people.
Yes.
And did a lot of good things for Yugoslavia.
Yes.
So in that respect, maybe your
right.
listeners can note no comparison intended on that plane.
Well, as with any, you know, analogy, there's significant differences. Now, as we mentioned, the former Yugoslavia was made up of all these different nations that have been, you know, kind of at each other's throats for quite some time. Serbians in particular, from my reading. But now, let's look at Iraq now. Is it just three nations? I mean, is it the Kurds, the Shiites, and the Sunnis? Is it divided strictly that way? What do we know about what's going on inside those borders that were drawn by the British?
I read a post somewhere the other day. Iraq is a state but not a nation.
Exactly.
The Kurds are a nation but not a state. That's worth some thought, all right? However, I mentioned, not to get too egg-heady with your readers, but with your listeners, but I mentioned in my column, historian, French historian, 19th century, Ernest Renan, okay? Very well-known guy. Wrote a history of the Jewish people, a life of Jesus, a lot of very sort of weighty books, honored man during his time. He wrote an essay, a lecture, and delivered it in 1882 at the Sorbonne, What is a Nation? All right? And he argued it has nothing to do with race, it has nothing to do with ethnicity, it has nothing to do with religion. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
It indeed has nothing to do with geography. He called it a daily plebiscite. Right?
Interesting.
You vote every time you participate in the everyday life of your society, you vote for that society, right? When you stop, you vote against, all right? I like it. It's a very early and persuasive declaration of secularism. Some of your readers may remember the French developed a real thing about secularism, laïcité, they call it, because the church in pre-revolutionary France was immensely powerful.
Yes.
So, not surprising, this came out of a French thinker. I think there's something to be carried forward from that. What is a nation? All right?
Yes.
I'm not for nations. I'm not for, well, I'm not for going into Iraq full stop, but I'm not for watching Iraq divide up according to ethnicities and religious sects and so on and so forth. No. By the way, I apply the same line of thinking to Israel and Palestine, right?
Sure.
I'm not for it. I don't think it's healthy. I don't think that's what nations are all about, or should be.
Yeah.
And so I would be for, let's coin it now, Bert.
Okay.
I'd be for a one-state solution in Iraq, and I think the mountain to be climbed is one that puts people past all these communal and sectarian animosities so that they can propel themselves into the future in a promising unitary way and be a people with a place on the map and rather than fragment out into countries that have no particular significance you know and are this lingering conscious of ethnicity is right there every day. No, I think we need to get past that, and they do too.
Well, we're speaking on the Bert Cohen Show with Patrick Smith. His new article on Salon is George W. Bush's horrific, deadly blunder. Would Saddam Hussein be better than Iraq's new hell? We're talking about that now, and the new guy in charge, it seems like Obama and his team are trying to distance themselves just a little bit. You write that Nouri al-Maliki and his brand of Shiite chauvinism, you call it that. Tell us about that, and how much has hatred of Maliki played into support for ISIS, the bands of roving, well-armed people who are destroying what's now Iraq. How much did hatred of him play into support of ISIS?
Hatred of al-Maliki you can read about on page A1 of the New York Times this morning, all right? ISIS is now making common cause with all manner of people who are intent on toppling this government, all right? Including the Baathists, right?
Yes.
The old rump Saddam people, all right? Of whom there are many, with a certain, to us perhaps remarkable, measure of support. Now, this goes exactly to my previous point. If we're going to be, if Iraqis are going to be, you're up, you're down, you're in or out, and we're now a Shiite government, and we're now a Sunni dominated government, whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
It's an endless cycle. This has to be exited. Okay, but the anti-Maliki bit is all about Shiite chauvinism, and that's no more correct than any other kind of chauvinism,
mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's going to be resolved by simply removing him and installing another one, if you see what I mean. It's pretty easy. I don't need to belabor the point.
Well, what options does Barack Obama have now? I mean, there's just... It seems to me an unbelievable mess, and of course the Republicans will find a way to blame him for the entire craziness here and horror. But there's some pressure on him to use drones to attack, to send back in a few troops to attack. It seems he's trying to push Nouri al-Maliki out of power and put. Somehow, I mean, it's like we have control over this. Like we're the locus of power here in Washington, D.C. Have somebody who can do what you're saying. Have perhaps another strong man, if you will, like Marshall Tito, to hold the country together by giving respect to all these different people. What can Barack Obama and his administration do now, realistically? What do you think they should do? What do you think they will do?
Well, Bert, good, very good question. And there are two planes of reply, okay?
Sure.
One is the immediate. And, of course, you're never going to get diplomats or State Department policy planners to think about more than what comes up in the matter of crisis management.
True.
Okay. So, in the immediate, we can say drones, we can say aerial bombing, and so on and so forth. I would object. We have a monumentally violent circumstance. Is the solution to add to that? Equally, no troops, right? No American troops. That seems to be the new rule. Good enough.
But no boots on the ground.
I don't think it's any more correct to send American pilots into this situation in behalf of a sectarian ruler. It's no more correct than sending American troops or even drones in the service of what, right? So I think there's a lot of fog that way. And in the presence of fog, I would say do nothing, right? I think we owe Iraq, not any particular leader, but we owe Iraq a very great deal, having put them in this mess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's the other plane. The other plane, which, again, the planners, one wishes they would get there, but I don't know. All right, we live in a new century. We need to reimagine our stance toward the world, what we do. That requires first going back and making an honest assessment of how it all went in the last century. We're not capable of that honest assessment.
No.
Yet.
It doesn't seem so.
Until we stop flinching from that, we will continue to make the same mistakes. It's not an original thought, but it's right in front of us now. So I think in the longer term, one wants to see, I'm just going to write about this in the next few weeks, we need, not to get too ethereal, but we need a sort of new consciousness. We can't keep applying the same set of assumptions about ourselves, about how the world works, about power, about military primacy, territorial dominion, and what have you. We can't keep applying all that. We need to have a new set of thinkers. So that reaches down fairly deep. And I don't see this consciousness in our policy people being turned out by Tufts and Georgetown and so on and so forth and populating the think tanks and so forth. It's just not there. So, you know, it's quite... I'm discouraged. I'm not a declinist or a defeatist. An Indian friend said to me, I asked him if he was an optimist or a pessimist. He said, if I weren't an optimist, why would I bother doing anything? That's my bin.
Well, there's also this little thing called Congress, which is always running for re-election. And thinking long-term just doesn't seem in the least bit possible. And, you know, the Republicans are going to, no matter what the president does, how much of a stumbling block to any kind of realistic, you know, trying to help tone it down and bring a little peace to Iraq? How much of a problem is that?
Congress, look, I realize, Bert, and your listeners will already be aware of this. I realize I come over rather idealistically, but I think it's the position to take now. Congress is... because we need to get beyond this.
Yes, we do.
This paralysis. It's just no good. One of the questions I often raise, well, sometimes raise, is America capable of self-correction? We need to ask ourselves that. And that applies to policy. I first raised it after the Bush-Gore election. Is America capable of self-correction? The Congress question you just raised, you have to look at it and say, not under circumstances now, and here's why, all right? I won't be telling your listeners anything new, all right? Mm-hmm. As long as the people making law, and in this case, campaign finance law, are the beneficiaries of the corruption, it is not reasonable to expect them to do anything about it.
Mm.
Okay, that's what the French call angelism, right? Boy Scout idealism.
Mm.
They just ain't going to do it. And so that's an example of what I mean by incapable of self-correction. It's just a dead end. Same in policy, I think, so far. I do not see how our diplomacy, our policy planners, can find their way to the sort of new course I'm suggesting is absolutely vital if this country is going to do well in the 21st century, and I certainly want it to.
Yes. And there are certainly better options than the ones we have taken now. And, you know, going back to reality on the bloody ground in Iraq right now, I wonder, tell us about the place of religion in the current Iraqi violence and their society and their politics. Is secularism something foreign to Iraqi culture?
No. No, it's not. I think it would be wrong to say, you know, the question of secularism, okay? You have secular tradition all through history in a lot of different places, including the Middle East, all right? What we have in the Enlightenment period here, church and state began to separate,
yes,
all right? And we have elevated church-state separation and secularism to a bedrock principle, more or less beyond question.
Yes.
Actually, the German thinker Habermas wrote a very curious book a few years ago called An Awareness of What Is Missing, actually questioning church-state separation.
Really?
But that's Habermas. So we have it as a principle, all right? Now, there's a tradition of church-state separation in the Middle East, okay? Nasser was for it.
True.
The Baathists were, that was their platform, okay? They were into sort of Nasserite socialism.
And Nasser, of course, was the leader of Egypt in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, no. Yes, that's right. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Abdul Nasser.
Yes. Well, and
you have this tradition. The difference is that Islamic civilization does not separate as a matter of principle, as we have in the Enlightenment West, church and state, necessarily. All right? You have to fit. We have emergent democracy in the Middle East. It's one of the most exciting things going on over there. It's terribly violent and difficult. I think they're going to get there. But this is what it's about. How do we develop democratic institutions and structures in the context of Islamic civilization? That's it.
Yeah.
In Egypt was another try. I thought a far more promising try than he was given credit for, because before Susan Rice and Secretary of State Kerry authorized the coup last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's off to a good start.
In Iraq, there, yeah, it's obviously it's there. There's a Shiite interpretation of how Islam should fit into government. There is a Sunni interpretation. And there is a secular interpretation. You have the same thing in Iran, by the way. Plenty of secularists in Iran.
Yeah. So Saddam Hussein's Baathist party is now illegal. I guess there is no Baathist party anymore. If there is, it's certainly way underground. What were they? Would it be fair to say Iraq might be in better shape were the Baathist party still around, still a power?
I don't know whether I'm I don't know whether I'm comfortable walking that far along the line.
Okay.
Bert.
Okay.
I couldn't say.
Well, what were they?
The Baathists were basically the ideology was Arab nationalism. Okay, this was something we tend not to remember terribly well. All right, but it was a kind of Arab identity transcending all the lines on maps, and you had Baathists in Syria, right, and across the border in Iraq. That's how it worked.
Uh-huh.
Right, it was a kind of the best I can do, Arab consciousness, okay?
Uh-huh.
You had at one time the Pan-Arab Republic. Remember that?
Yes, vaguely.
Remember that undertaking? It never went anywhere. But that was the sort of idea, okay? I think the Arab world is not done with figuring out how that might work. That's what ISIS is about in the context of Islam. The Baathists had a secular interpretation. But before we go into would it be better off, I can't step there.
Okay.
Because you have all kinds of questions of corruption and repression and all the rest of it. I wouldn't want to answer that. It wouldn't be right.
And we're talking here with Patrick Smith, whose new article, George W. Bush's Horrific Deadly Blunder, Would Saddam Hussein Be Better Than Iraq's New Hell? Part of the problem with Saddam Hussein was corruption, and it seems to me, from everything I've read, that part of the big problem with Nouri al-Maliki is the perception of tremendous corruption. How much power do you think Nouri al-Maliki still has? Is it possible for him to lead unity negotiations to help hold Iraq together, as it appears the State Department would prefer? How possible is that, or is he beyond any hope?
I don't know. He's probably beyond it. I mean, my position is nothing for al-Maliki until he starts what we used to call all parties talks. Okay,
uh-huh.
Nothing. There's no point. He hasn't demonstrated his capability of that. I read a piece overnight saying the Bush people. I mean, sorry. The Obama people are actually considering prying him out, sending him on his way, because they don't think he's up to it. They're probably right, but he's there. He's the PM. Unity talks right now. If he can do that, and not just with the Kurds, also with the Sunnis, and credibly representative talks, all right? Everything is represented. That's how I would proceed. Is he up to it? I kind of doubt it,
right.
But that's the position right now. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention about that headline. Writers aren't headline writers.
Uh-huh.
I'll stay with the headline as it is. Okay. But here's the bitter thing I had to consider in that column, or I wanted to consider. I don't know whether we have casualty counts and all that sort of stuff, but we have rough numbers. I'm hard-pressed to think that Saddam was guilty of calamities of anything like the magnitude the Americans have caused and in large measure inflicted on Iraqis since 2003. I don't see it.
Yeah, it just...
I don't think Saddam was that guilty. That's it.
Well,
face that.
But at least he did hold the country together, and the calamities have been just unbelievable. Now, the American policy toward Iraq, at least at this point, appears to have been an absolute total failure, although they have had an election, in quotes. Were there differences between the Bush policy and Obama's policy?
Obama's the heir. Obama is the inheriting leader. He didn't concoct it. He inherited a standing situation. I think his intent was to get out of it, but as I've written elsewhere, I think you have this phenomenon, you want to call it the deep state or whatever, but very, very entrenched institutional consciousness, the intelligence agencies and defense, all right?
Yes.
He's proven incapable of, well, for stage one, he proved incapable of turning that cargo ships around, all right? Stage two, he seems to be kind of into it himself, right?
What do you mean?
I'm not an Obama man.
Right.
He didn't. I don't think he would ever sort of architect this Iraqi situation. I don't know. It's another one of those questions we can't really answer. But he hasn't. I think he could have done more to get us out of it than he has. I remember my dear friend Chalmers Johnson, just not so long before he left us, said to me, when Obama named Gates defense secretary, inheriting Gates from Bush, I knew there was nothing to expect from this administration.
Yeah, the institutions just keep on rolling.
You have to wonder.
I'm sorry?
Why did he do that, you have to wonder? Why did he name Gates? You start to wonder whether the tail isn't wagging the dog, which is kind of a frightening thought.
Really? Well, I've heard it discussed in various places that right now what's going on, the tremendous bloodletting on the soil of Iraq, is a proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. I'm not sure I understand what that means. Do you have a sense of that? What are the two interests there, and how true could that be?
Right. Well, I think that's quite right. I direct your readers to a piece. It's mentioned in my column, the column that put us together, by a remarkable correspondent stroke commentator for the English Daily, The Independent, Robert Fisk. He's very, very good. He's been at it many years. He's got a lot of dirt under his fingernails, let's say.
Oh, good.
Our dear friends, the Saudis,
yes,
are financing ISIS, right? Why?
Yeah, why?
The Saudis, you have Wahhabist Islam ideology, all right? And they're very vigorously Sunni, all right? And they are financing ISIS because that's what the insurgents represent, right? So
yes,
it's consistent for them. But then they turn around and they're our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis are dead set against the Iranians, who are Shiite.
They're Persian, too,
so
yeah.
We now have the Saudis, rather oddly, lining up with Israel, frightened to death of these nuclear talks between Washington and Tehran, right? And then we have other layers. The Qataris have been financing the insurgents in Syria, all right? Because they're Sunni. Qataris are Sunni, and the insurgents in Syria are Sunni, attacking Assad, who is Alawite. I'm sorry, listeners are going to find this complicated, but Assad is an Alawite, which is a sect of Shia Islam, okay? So now the Robert Fisk tells us, a remarkable piece, great piece. Well, the Qataris are thinking about switching and putting their financial back. There's a lot of money flowing around over there.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone wonders where all the guns are coming from, switching their financial backing away from the insurgents, the Sunni insurgents, and to back Assad, although he is an Alawite. The Qataris are scared of the Saudis, who are also Sunni. It's just a bowl of spaghetti. Who are also Sunni, because the Saudis may get angry at the Qataris, right, for other things. So If you can tell me the place of the United States in all this, please drop a line. Right?
Oh, my goodness. It does get very confusing. And I'm reminded a little bit of what happened in to start the Great War. There were all these, you know, angry different groups and nations all looking at each other. And then the peacemaker, Wilson, got in late in the First World War, and he wanted to make the world safe for democracy, and it was a war to end all wars. And of course, it blew things up even worse, for sure. And of course, resulted in the tragedy of the Second World War. How relevant is that failure of Woodrow Wilson, which began 100 years ago, to realities today?
Well, very is my short answer. Okay,
yes.
Step back from our bowl of spaghetti and ask, what is that all about? What's the upsum? Give us, what's the executive summary there?
Well,
it's this, all right? Islam is trying to find its place in modern institutions.
Yeah, in the world.
What's going on? It's one way in Iran, it's another way in Egypt, it's another way here, there, and everywhere. It's more or less violent. Tunisia is on an interesting experiment, okay? That's what's going on, all right? We don't have a place in that. We cannot export our notions of democracy, democratic institutions. This is part of our tragedy. We don't really have anything to boast about in terms of democratic institutions anymore, do we? Even if we did, it's not our scene. It's not our place. Wilsonianism was based on the notion inherited from, remember, Wilson was the son of a Presbyterian minister, okay?
Evangelism.
Some of my best friends are Presbyterians, if your listeners happen to be confused about that remark. He was a deeply religious man.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
His consciousness was a 20th century restatement of the 17th century inheritance, pre-independence, the religious drives that pushed this nation forward and told it what it was. It was an act of God. It was the promised land. It was the forward edge of humanity. We owed it to the rest of the world,
yes,
to show them how to do more or less everything.
Mm, mm, mm.
That was Wilsonianism.
And we're still there.
That's why I say it was fated from the first to fail. It was a miscalculation. It was sheer false consciousness. It was a terrible misunderstanding of what America was. And this is the core of my book. These are the two poles of my book. There's a mythical notion of America. We have it in front of us now in the form of the Tea Party, but it goes back to the 17th century. And then there's an historical notion of America, having to do with our responsibility for who we are. We live in history. There's no providence, etc. The historicists need to gain the upper hand. They never really have.
Yeah, for sure.
During the Progressive Era, and then maybe during the Depression, they had a shot at it. But we are driven by... Well, Bush was neo-Wilsonian, basically. That's the consciousness, right? We're here to do this. It's nothing to do with international law. It's not only our right, it's our duty,
right?
There's no place for it in our century.
Mm. We're talking again with Patrick Smith, whose new article is titled George W. Bush's Horrific Deadly Blunder, Would Saddam Hussein Be Better Than Iraq's New Hell? It's on Salon. And the book you're talking about, is it Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century? Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes.
And I need to bring up a local resident, Lee Downer, is a retired major general with the U.S. Air Force. He wrote in a local newspaper a very interesting piece from a military guy. He said, quote, "The U.S. Embassy, with thousands of people in Baghdad, could create for ISIS a strategic target similar to that of Dien Bien Phu for the Vietnamese." He writes that to prevent further disaster, it's time we really leave Iraq. Comments on that observation?
Wow. Very interesting, isn't it? I love people with sort of a reservoir of historical knowledge to
draw. Oh, isn't it great? Yeah.
I mean, Dien Bien Phu, who would have thought? But not bad. Gets you to think.
And Dien Bien Phu, for listeners who may not remember, 1954 was the French fort, impregnable fort. It was their last stand, and they were defeated by the Vietnamese nationalists. And
the great General Giap.
Yes.
Who is still alive.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, our presence there is an irritant, you know, is a terrible irritant. I don't think at the moment it is the main event. The main event now is al-Maliki, his defense or deposition, one or the other. But I don't think, you know, after the Arab Spring, everybody remarked about, or most of the journalists remarked about Egypt, you know, hey, there's no real animosity toward America here. It's all about Mubarak. Well, that was so. But I think we would be radically mistaken to think that the Arab world is not very highly conscious of American and more broadly Western culpability in their 20th and now 21st century predicaments and suffering.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So is it going to be a strategic target? I don't know. I love the general's remark or the officer's remark, but I don't think it's on their minds. I don't think it's front burner right now. It's certainly not my impression. I'm not there, of course. But my point is, no, they're after the prime minister. They're on the record, in fact. But my corollary is, don't mistake that for anything approaching goodwill toward him.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, again, looking at history, as we are wont to do on the Bert Cohen Show, the world is well aware of the killing fields of Cambodia, but most of us are less aware of Henry Kissinger's absolutely monstrous carpet bombing of what had been a relatively, and I hate to use this word, but I can't think of another, primitive society. The Pol Pot regime, the violent, bloodthirsty Pol Pot regime, came as a direct result of the policies of Henry Kissinger and President Nixon. My question relative to that bit of history is, how responsible is the U.S. for the current tragedy?
You know, sometimes readers say, oh, Patrick, you're always, we can always count on you to stand against the Americans. I consider that a very large misinterpretation of my point. I think we are hugely responsible, possibly primarily responsible, depending on the circumstance, okay? Because we misinterpret the question of intervention and its correctness. There are times when human predicaments transcend national borders. We mustn't elevate them to some kind of sacred status. I'm not with the Chinese in their, you know, the way we are into the separation of church and state. It's nobody questions it. For the Chinese, it's and others, it's the internal affairs of others. That can be taken too far. But we've gone in the other direction, and it has led us into a degree of responsibility. The good part of the question is, it has led us into a degree of responsibility we are not willing to face. We're willing to act as we do, but we're never willing to take responsibility for the outcomes.
True.
Right?
Yes.
Have you ever heard any president or senator stand up, except in the interests of political bashing, stand up and say, gee, we really failed in the Middle East since we toppled Mossadegh in 1953. Bad stuff. Yeah. I haven't heard anybody say that.
Yeah, true. Well, yeah. One thing I've learned from history is that we never seem to learn from history. Now,
we don't like history, you see.
It's
the State Department absolutely relies on the complete absence of history in its entire presentation.
Okay. Well, I have to ask.
They insist we live and think in a sort of eternal present. There's no past.
Oh, is that ever a mistake? 4,000 Americans died. Who knows how many Iraqis have died. Many Americans were grievously wounded. As you mentioned, no government ever wants to acknowledge that these young men may have suffered, men and women may have suffered and died in vain, perhaps for nothing. Did they?
In my view, it is the bitterest truth. I think it's very difficult to say anything of any worth about this situation to the bereaved families.
Yeah.
It's disaster. What am I going to say? My heart goes out to them? They don't need that.
No.
A Hallmark card sort of sentiment.
Mm.
But it doesn't take away from the obligation to face this bitter truth. And the truth is, it's come to nothing. It's come to nothing. And here's my take, Bert. If we can face that truth, if we can advance beyond this and say, Iraq was a mistake, and it was a mistake because a lot of other things were a mistake before it,
mm-hmm.
and we're in a bad consciousness about ourselves and our relations with the rest of the world, then those men and women will not have died in vain. That's what we can do.
Interesting. Interesting.
Right? And I don't want to think that they've died in vain. As it is now, if we go on and on and on the way we are, they will have, and more will.
And as you say there's a positive side to this debacle, and that, quote, my fondest hope is that one of our very oldest ideas now teeters near collapse. How tell us about how that's positive. What do you mean by that?
I'm going to try and put this in a book someday. I often argue for the optimism buried in the pessimism, okay? We need to... I have great faith in this country. So many good people and diverse, imaginative, energetic thinkers and all that, right? Good intentions all around. We need to allow and accommodate ourselves to the collapse of certain of our principles, because they are going to be more and more, well, they were wrong from the first,
right.
Illusory. I'm referring to the Wilsonian principle and all that.
Yeah.
But they are, apart from being wrong from the first, they are not 21st century technology. The rest of the world is done with it. Okay? They don't, there's no more we want to be like you, all that.
It's, I know.
We've exhausted the goodwill on this side. Everybody knows about anti-Americanism and how prevalent it is, all right? So if we can let go of these things, we can enter a new era. And that, to me, is full of promise. A great book I recommend to your readers. I mentioned it in the book that you've mentioned here, mine. It's called The Cultural Defeat. It's by a German man named Wolfgang Schivelbusch, right? And he talks about the consequences of victory and defeat. I'll try to say this quickly. What happens to a defeated nation? Well, everyone that goes into conflict of any time, any kind, military or otherwise, is convinced of its victory, right? So what happens to the defeated? They must go back and say, our worldview is wrong. We got it wrong. It didn't hold. So we better reimagine ourselves.
Yeah.
And come back again with something new.
Yeah, right? It is quite an opportunity.
Think of the Germans now, and think of the Japanese now, and think of the Spanish after we took their empire away. This is the culture of defeat. The defeat is a sort of the mulch of reinvention, right?
And
what happens to the victor? The victor goes home and says, "Man, we got it right. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to do any thinking. We don't have to do any analysis. We have to stay with it just as it is."
Hmm.
And so this is a sort of cyclical notion of the kind of yin and yang of history and of victory and defeat, right? I think we are in need. We had a chance after 1975.
Yes, absolutely.
Today, we were defeated.
I know, of course we were.
We examined things.
And we never learned.
I think that's what Jimmy Carter's point was, you see. I think Carter had the audacity, and I think he's due for his revisionist historian.
Absolutely. Definitely. Yes.
I think Carter had the audacity to say, hey, my fellow Americans, as they all say, we got that wrong. We need a rethink. I'm going to put Miss Pat Darien in there as a deputy assistant for human rights and so forth. Everybody's horrified, right? And it brought him down. Reagan in the particular character he had, because the narrative had to be corrected back to
the mythic,
the terrible swift sword, and so on. And so.
Yeah.
And so we missed our opportunity to enter into the culture of defeat. And at the bottom of the culture of defeat, I find deep, profound, a kind of glorious optimism. You can turn a leaf. You can do it again another way.
Wow, this has been very informative. We have to run. Thank you so much. It's been very, very informative. Patrick Smith, you can read him on Salon. His book is Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
You're welcome, Bert.
The day is blue, there's nothing to do but watch the sad review of life going by. All the broken people in a world of hurt, and all the hungry people crying in the streets, while all the children pray for peace.